The world's coral reefs are magnificent living organisms that are teeming with life.
Corals are not the only things that live on coral reefs.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to one of the leading scientists studying the reefs and find out if their future is bright. We'll also meet the scientist who developed a test to detect the new human coronavirus. And we'll spend an academic minute finding out if your diet can help heal your brain. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Callum Roberts is one of the world's leading ocean scientists. He currently teaches marine conservation at York University in England. Roberts has written extensively on the topic and was the chief scientific advisor on Sir David Attenborough's BBC series Blue Planet 2. In his new book called Reef Life, an Underwater Memoir, Roberts illuminates the science of our oceans and reefs while weaving in stories of his adventures over the last four decades. Professor Roberts spoke with The Best of Our Knowledge's Elizabeth Hill, talking about coral reefs and how they're able to sustain such vast ecosystems.
Coral reefs are rich ecosystems which are found bordering the shores of tropical coasts. They have developed over thousands of years of growth, largely as a result of corals, an organism which combines both animal and plant and mineral in the same creature. What corals do is that the coral animal extracts dissolved calcium carbonate from seawater and secretes it as a skeleton made of the same substance as chalk. Now, they get a lot of their energy from a plant which is embedded within their tissues, and this is a little kind of microscopic plant called zooxanthellae. And the partnership between the coral animal and the plant dates back about 100 million years. And when evolution created this coral animal plant hybrid, suddenly these corals were able to slap down calcium carbonate skeletons faster than anything that had come before. And that was when they really started to build coral reefs as geologically resilient edifices that are now so big that they can be seen from space. The Great Barrier Reef, the Maldives in the middle of the Indian Ocean, the Mesoamerican Barrier Reef off the coast of Belize and Mexico, these are all enormous reef systems that have been created by the long-term building action of millions and millions of coral animals. And each coral animal consists of a colony of polyps, each of which is like a sea anemone, and most of which are so small that you need a magnifying glass to see them. And yet they create these structures which are visible, as I say, from space.
What drew you to this work?
Well, coral reefs are magical places to work and to study. And for a biologist, they're as close to heaven as you can get on Earth, I think. When I was a student, I was lucky enough to be given the opportunity to go and help a team of people researching the distribution of coral reefs along the Red Sea coast of Saudi Arabia. And as a 20-year-old, I got my first opportunity to dive into a coral reef there, and it blew my mind. I mean, when you finally walk your way over the reef crest where the waves are breaking and dive into the water beyond, you're confronted with this immensely vibrant, colorful scene with hundreds and thousands of fish milling around. They seem to have no fear of you. They will come right up to you. They'll inspect you, and then they'll just carry on with their daily lives. And so it was an immediately engaging system to start studying.
What new techniques or new information has arisen that you're teaching in your classrooms today?
Well, coral reefs are an extraordinary ecosystem because in less than 0.1% of the area of the oceans, they contain something like a quarter of all the shallow water species that live in the sea. And so they are immensely rich. They are the richest places that you can visit in terms of the sheer variety of wildlife that occurs on them. And that is one of the fascinations of coral reefs. How do so many species manage to coexist? So when I'm teaching about coral reefs, I concentrate on the wonders of that evolutionary exuberance that we see on reefs. And I talk about how such richness and diversity is possible and how it's built up through geological time. But the other side of coral reefs is a somewhat darker side. And that is that coral reefs are now recognized to be among the most vulnerable of all ecosystems to global climate change. Over the last 37 years or so in which I've been studying reefs, I've seen them transform in many parts of the world from rich and vibrant and exuberant ecosystems into things that have been degraded, where much of the coral has been killed, and they have lost a lot of that vigor and diversity. And the reason for that is that the relationship between the coral animal and the microscopic plant inside it is very temperature sensitive. And when you push the temperature of the seawater more than 1 degree centigrade above the normal maximum to which they're exposed and keep it there for a period of a couple of months, then the corals get severely stressed and they have to kick out their plant partners. Otherwise, the plant partners will kind of kill the coral. And in kicking them out, they end up starving because the plants produce much of their food. And if the temperatures don't go down again soon enough, then and they can regain these plant partners, then the corals die. And usually what happens is that the corals die. So we've seen massive loss of coral across whole oceans over the last 20 years. In 1997-98, there was a global mass bleaching event. It's called a bleaching event because when the corals kick out these plants, they lose their pigments and they turn this kind of deathly white color. And that mass bleaching caused 70 to 95% of the coral across the Indian Ocean to die. And it has struggled to recover. In some places, there's been fairly good recovery, in other places, less so. But then along comes another mass bleaching event. And we saw one from 2014 to 2017. Propagating around the world from the Eastern Pacific through the Indian Ocean and killing more corals. So corals are really on the front lines of climate change and are suffering enormously from it.
Can you talk about your student expeditions to the Maldives?
Every year I'm lucky enough to take a class of master's students to the Maldives to study coral reefs and what is happening to them in terms of climate change impacts. The Maldives is a great place to do that because it was at the epicenter of one of these bleaching events 20 years ago, and it suffered again in recent years. And so what we've seen is the way that a reef is affected by episodes of warming water and how it surges back from it again. What's encouraging, at least, is that the second time around, the coral mass bleaching wasn't nearly as bad as the first time around. And a lot of the corals on the deep, cooler water slopes of the atolls managed to survive. And so my students can see how there are these natural refuges from which the corals can recover and replenish the areas that have been literally cooked by the warm water event. But other than that, you know, my students just love to see the variety of life on reefs. And of course, they still are full of fish life and other sorts of invertebrates. Corals are not the only things that live on coral reefs. They provide a home for thousands of other species. And so even though they have lost a lot of coral in recent years, there is still so much else to see.
With the changes that you've seen, you still believe there's absolutely no reason to abandon them to their fate, coral reefs. Why? What can be done?
Well, a few people have suggested that there's no way that we can save coral reefs in their present state, so therefore we shouldn't bother, we shouldn't waste money doing so. But actually, that's a really crazy attitude. For one thing, there are some countries in the world that are entirely dependent on coral reefs. So countries like the Maldives, Tuvalu in the Pacific, they are consisting of, entirely of low-lying atolls and islands, and they will suffer greatly. They may even disappear if the corals die and the reefs degrade. So for them, it's an existential imperative for them to try and find solutions to protect coral reefs better and to give them a better chance of adapting to the changing world environment. But of course, even if corals are lost from coral reefs, there are many, many other things that live on them. And I've seen in the Maldives areas which were severely affected by the bleaching mortality 20 years ago and where there's been very little comeback for one reason or another by the corals. You know, the seabed is maybe 3% living coral. Mostly you'd expect it to be 40, 50% living coral in a healthy reef environment. But despite that, it has been strongly protected from other sources of human damage and harm. So it's protected entirely from fishing, for example. And so diving onto that reef is an extraordinary experience. There are entire rivers of fish flowing over the bottom in places you can't see the seabed for fish. And there are turtles, there are huge shoals of jacks which are streaming past towards the open sea. It is an incredible experience. And so coral reefs, even though they are in a more degraded state, with good protection, they can still thrive. They can still support fisheries in adjacent areas. They can still provide incredible experiences for tourism, and they will still support the livelihoods of local people. If we abandon them, they will do none of those. It always saddens you to see a decline of a much-loved friend, and coral reefs have been, for me, a constant presence throughout my career. There are places where they are still in wonderful shape, and they're well-protected, and they're beautiful, and they're rich. And what keeps me going, though, is the compulsion to try and protect them more and to heal some of the damage that we're doing. I do see a lot of progress on that internationally. So it's easy to focus on all the negatives, but actually, you know, we are doing a good job in many places. We are getting better. We understand these systems better. And politically, we're taking action both at national and international scales in order to up the amount of ocean protection. So to be honest, I am optimistic.
Still to come, Elizabeth Hill's conversation with Callum Roberts continues with a look at the need for more students to study the sea. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Professor Callum Roberts, one of the world's leading ocean scientists. He currently teaches marine conservation at York University in England. He's speaking with The Best of Our Knowledge's Elizabeth Hill.
Is there a need for more students to get involved in marine conservation?
I think in the world today, we are facing more and more environmental problems. As the humans' population grows and our impact on the environment increases, there is an ever-growing demand for people who know how to look after the environment, know how to restore it and rebuild populations. And that occurs both in land and sea. We need more and more people who are engaged, who learn the skills, who become professionals, who look after the environment. I train my students to become good stewards of the environment. Many of them now are in wonderful positions in environmental organizations, in governments, in agencies, in research institutes, and they're all seeking solutions to help make the planet a more healthy, vibrant place, even as human needs rise. So yes, I think there is every reason for us to train more people. There is a great future ahead for those whose careers take them towards looking after the environment.
Are there steps that everyday people can take to help better the environment, especially when it comes to coral reefs and water pollution?
I think the first thing to say is that individual actions matter. Individual actions multiplied many thousands or millions of times matter more. You know, what we do as individuals is important at a global scale. So, for example, traveling less by air, changing our diets to have less impact on the environment, using less materials like plastics, these are all good things we can do. But this is also a time of extraordinary opportunity and a need for action at a political scale. And we need to empower the politicians who lead us to take the right actions to protect the environment. So become politically active. Write to your senator or congressman about your concerns on the environment. Tell them that you want to see action on climate change. These are important things which will help change the path of the 21st century and move us towards a more sustainable world, and one which is richer than we'll be if we fail to take that responsibility right now.
Would you care to comment on the rollback of the many environmental initiatives by the current administration in the United States?
It's very disappointing to see the hostility of the current administration to environmental concerns and rolling back safeguards over pollutants in the environment, for example, or on public lands. These are problems which it would be much better if we didn't have to deal with alongside all the pressures of the modern world. Political leadership, as we realize, on both sides of the Atlantic is difficult to come by in a good form. We need good political leaders more than ever, and we're struggling to find them. I think that we mustn't give up. Canada had an administration which for a time was very hostile towards the environment, and now the administration is much more pro-environment. These things will pass, as my Canadian colleagues say. And I think that what is gratifying to see from my side of the Atlantic looking towards yours is that at a lower level than the national level, states and cities are still taking action to combat climate change, to shift to renewable energy, to reduce pollution. And that is really important. And so those local actions, those state actions, are critical to move us to a more sustainable future.
I'd like to do a checkup on something the UN did in 2015, and it devoted one of its 17 sustainable development goals exclusively to the state of the oceans. Is it doing what it was meant to do? Do you think it's on the right track? Has it kind of fallen wayside?
So Sustainable Development Goal 14 was dedicated to life underwater, both in freshwater and in the ocean. And one of the key targets there is to establish 10% of the ocean as marine protected areas by 2020. And by some analyses, we've got 7% of the ocean covered in marine protected areas. By others, which are a little more restrictive in what they allow, we've got about 5%. So we're moving in the right direction, and there are some people who think that we will achieve 10% by 2020. Certainly we'll get to 10% within a year or two of 2020, but we already know that this target is not high enough. The science that we've done says that we need to be protecting something like 30% of the ocean from exploitation and human harm in order to safeguard the sea, in order to achieve all the things that we want to do with marine protected areas, including fisheries enhancement. So good fisheries require healthy stocks. And marine protected areas help to build up stocks of fish, and they can spill over the benefits into surrounding areas which can be exploited. So I think we're moving in the right direction, not fast enough, but 10% protection will only be a waypoint on the way towards greater protection. And this year in China, there's going to be a meeting of the Convention on Biological Diversity, which will decide what the target should be for the next 10 years. And I'm really hopeful that we will see international agreement to establish a new target of 30% ocean protection by 2030.
That was York University professor Callum Roberts discussing his career in marine conservation with the best of our knowledge's Elizabeth Hill. You can read about Roberts' experiences in his new book, Reef Life, an Underwater Memoir, which is published by Pegasus. In December 2019, a cluster of atypical pneumonia patients epidemiologically linked to a wholesale market in Wuhan, China, was detected. Wild animals are sold at that market. A novel beta coronavirus named 2019 Novel Coronavirus has been identified in some of these patients. It's similar to viruses that caused SARS and MERS. Because of the potential for pandemic spread, there was a great need for a rapid and accurate test for the detection of the virus. Dr. Leo Poon and his team from the School of Public Health at the University of Hong Kong have come up with a new molecular diagnostic assay that allows for the detection and quantification of this new coronavirus. I spoke with Dr. Poon and asked him to tell us about the cause of the current atypical pneumonia outbreak in China.
Right. This is actually caused by a new human coronavirus. In fact, it is completely new coronavirus in science. We never know this before. The virus looked like it's coming from animals and it's genetically related to SARS coronavirus found in 2003.
Where do you think this novel animal virus has come from?
Right. We don't have direct evidence at the moment. Some of these patients actually epidemiologically linked to a seafood market, which actually sell wild animal there. So we believe wild animal will be one of the possibility. Maybe this wild animal in the seafood market actually may acquire this virus and then it spread to human. And the origin of this novel coronavirus maybe also come from bat because it's genetically similar to other bat coronaviruses.
You and your colleagues have developed, seemingly in record time, an assay for detecting this virus. Can you tell us something about the assay and how you and your team developed this laboratory test?
Right. Basically, we developed two assays. But at the time of preparing these assays, we only know one public sequence about this novel coronaviruses. So what we did is actually try to also analyze bat viruses, which are genetically similar to these virus, and then try to look for the conserved region so that we can able to design some primer that can react with this clay of viruses. So, I mean, if we find a patient which are positive in this test, they should be concerned because they may acquire this virus or other bat-like viruses. So what we did is actually we developed two assays, one for the screening test, one for confirmatory test.
So how will having a laboratory test available help in the containment of the associated disease or in the treatment?
Basically, we can able to identify the patient early so that we can put them in prompt treatment and also try to quarantine these people. In addition, we can able to do active contact tracing so that we can able to identify those people who may have a close contact with these patients so that, again, we can monitor their health closely so that we can prevent further spreading of this disease in the community as well. This is what we did for SARS and also for MERS. So I think prompt identification of this patient help, first of all, reduce the further spreading of the disease in the community. Secondly, we may able to provide some sufficient supportive treatment to these patients.
Do we have a cure or a vaccine for this new coronavirus?
There are several groups which are actively working on this. And of course, we have the experience from SARS and MERS so that we should able to come up with some possible options much quicker than before. But it will take time. For example, I mean, we have to evaluate the efficacy of these vaccines. We have to develop better animal model to validate these vaccines. And also, we need to confirm it is safe to be used in humans. So, I mean, it will take time for the cure. And there are other people also try to identify some drugs which are able to control the virus replication. Again, that has to be evaluated by good clinical trial. So we have to wait and see. Right now, there may be some educated guess to identify some of the possible hit for treating these patients, but then we need further evidence to support that.
What's unique about this type of virus and the country of origin that may contribute to this pattern?
Right. There are many coronaviruses in all walks of life. I mean, basically, there are a lot of viruses like this in animals. I think the situation of SARS and now the current situation is because there is a very close contact of human to wild animals. So basically that facilitates the possibility of zoonotic transmissions. I think as long as there is a setting which allow people who can have a close contact with wild animal, that is a problem. And then now in China, they also consume wild animal. So that may be the issues. I think for future, not only China, but also other countries, we have to consider how we can provide safe food to our public so that we can prevent such zoonotic transmission in a community, and that may be leading to a major outbreak.
Dr. Leo Poon is with the School of Public Health at the University of Hong Kong. His paper is available online now and will appear in the April 2020 print edition of the journal Clinical Chemistry. High fat and low carbs can help you lose some weight. It may also mean a healthy brain. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Can your diet help with recovery from a traumatic brain injury? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Chris Dulla, associate professor of neuroscience at Tufts University, looks into this question.
Traumatic brain injuries are a rising concern. Both severe brain injuries, like those that occur in car accidents and combat, and milder injuries, like those associated with contact sports, can put you at risk for later neurological problems. So it's imperative to understand how the brain responds to injury and what we can do to improve the brain's ability to recover. Recent advances in the field of inflammation, immune system-brain interactions, and metabolism are providing new avenues for research into traumatic brain injury, as well as potential novel therapies to improve patient outcomes. My lab became interested in the link between metabolism and traumatic brain injury because of the ketogenic diet. This high-fat, low-carb diet forces the body to burn fat rather than glucose and has been used for hundreds of years to reduce epileptic seizures. It is still one of the most effective treatments for some forms of epilepsy. However, it's often difficult for patients to adhere to its strict regimen. We wanted to see if we could replicate the benefits of the keto diet using drug-based interventions. We are particularly interested in the possibility that manipulating brain metabolism could improve outcomes after traumatic brain injury. We knew that an injured brain uses more energy. If we could control the brain's ability to use energy, perhaps we could shape its response to the injury itself. We treated brain-injured mice with a drug that inhibited the metabolic pathway called glycolysis. This pathway allows the rapid utilization of glucose to provide energy. We found that inhibiting glycolysis after brain injury reduced the loss of inhibitory neurons, which are critical to controlling brain activity and preventing seizures. We are building on these results using genomic and biochemical approaches to understand how we can harness brain metabolism more precisely to shape neuronal activity and the response to injury.
That was Chris Dulla of Tufts University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledges podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org. ¶¶